I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Monday, the 19th of August. Mondays at 1 o'clock in the afternoon means it's time for All Things Political. And we'll have two guests with us during the course of this hour. The first half hour, Aaron Blake will join us from the Washington Post. And later on, Philip Bump, staff writer for the Atlantic Wire. We have a number of things to talk about. There's not a lot going on legislatively because everybody's on an August recess. But there are a number of issues that are of continuing attention. Rand Paul saying last week there was no objective evidence that African Americans are prevented from voting. We will talk about that and the continuing concern about voting rights, voting ID, voter fraud. Our guest the first half hour writes an interesting piece about New Jersey Governor Chris Christie telling the party leaders they need to stop worrying about philosophical debates and focus on winning elections. For our ideas to matter, we have to win, he says. What about suspending foreign aid to Egypt because of the violent clashes there? There are a number of lawmakers calling for that. Should we care about whether the next Federal Reserve Chair is Janet Yellen or Lawrence Summers? We will talk about that. And we have a number of other issues as well. Lawmakers denouncing NSA privacy violations and calling for some answers. We welcome phone calls for this hour. As always, our phone number is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. We always like to hear from you about all things political. And if you'd like to send an email, you can do that, talk@wpr.org, and start a conversation with differing ideas on our Facebook page, which is The Kathleen Dunn Show. We start with Aaron Blake, and Aaron is a writer for The Washington Post, and thank you very much for joining us. Hi, Aaron.
Thank you for having me.
Yeah, our pleasure. Why don't we start with Chris Christie? You wrote a very interesting piece about him recently, saying that, and I find this is really interesting, you say he is the most broadly popular Republican in the country. He fares better than any other Republican in potential 2016 presidential matchups. So you would have to assume, right, Aaron, that he's the guy.
Yes, except for we're dealing with the Republican Party of today, in which pragmatism is not necessarily the most valued characteristic for a candidate for office. You know, we're seeing in a lot of these Senate races that members of the conservative movement in particular would rather have somebody who's more pure on their issues than somebody who may be more moderate and may be more electable. So that's really the big tension in the Republican Party right now. And the interesting thing is that Christie's very much coming down on the side of pragmatism, trying to make that argument. And if he does run for president in 2016, I would expect him to continue to make that case.
When you look at the primaries that are coming up for the midterm elections, do you see a repeat of very, very conservative primary challenges? And considering who votes in those kinds of elections, that there will be a push for extremely conservative candidates?
There will be that tension in the primaries continuing. We've already seen, for example, Liz Cheney, the daughter of former Vice President Dick Cheney, mm-hmm. is running against Senator Mike Enzi in Wyoming. There are a few other examples of it. It's still kind of early in the primary season. There's a congressman in Idaho, for instance, who is an ally of John Boehner's, who is getting a primary challenger who's being supported by the Club for Growth, which is a big conservative group that often supports primary challengers against incumbents. So it's continuing. It's happened for the last several election cycles, and I would expect it to continue maybe even more than we've seen before, and I'll tell you why that is. The Tea Party movement was very much founded in opposition to President Obama, but it was also founded in opposition to the Republican Party leadership. Within the Republican Party, there is actually more opposition to the Republican leadership today than there has been in recent years. What that means is there could be more primary upsets, there could be more primary challengers, and we're going to have to see how that shakes out. But there's certainly an unrest inside the Republican Party, people looking for their party to redefine itself in some way. And so there are going to be people stepping forward and putting that to the test.
And the concern about the leadership is what?
Well, it's actually, it's hard to find out because the concern is pretty universal. Moderates in the party are just as concerned about their party leadership as conservatives are. A majority of both moderate Republicans and very conservative Republicans say that they're unhappy with their party's leadership. So it's not necessarily a situation where the leadership is being too conservative or being too moderate or willing to compromise too much or not willing to compromise enough. It seems that everybody is kind of alienated by the direction the party is heading in, and I think that just makes it so much harder for the party to find its way out of what has been a rough couple years for it.
There's been a lot in the news lately. We don't know who the new chair of the Federal Reserve will be. Should we care about this? Does it make a difference who it is and why there is a controversy about whether or not it should be Janet Yellen or Larry Summers? Somebody has described, maybe it was you even, this position as being the second most important office in the country. Is it? Who is it likely to be? Does it make a difference to all of us?
Yeah, you know, it's hugely important. This is a position that doesn't get a whole lot of press coverage. You know, obviously it's not exactly a presidential campaign that we're talking about here. Many of the things that they do are behind closed doors, and it's kind of a mysterious, you know, setup that they have. But they, you know, this is a very powerful office, and there's actually a very interesting race going on right now, if you can even call it a race, between Larry Summers and Janet Yellen, who both have significant constituencies in the Senate. Democratic senators have sent a letter promoting Yellen. Summers is seen as the guy who's kind of the favorite of the administration, but there's obviously some people who aren't terribly, you know, aren't going to let that happen necessarily. They're pushing for Yellen. So it's going to be interesting to see whether the administration picks one of those two or if they go with a third candidate that maybe people aren't even talking about right now.
I don't know if you saw this or not. There was this handy comparison chart, the Fed Chair edition that Daily Kos published over the weekend. Yellen is described as a whole list of things, but she's described at the end as would be the choice of the Obama of hope and change, whereas Summers would be the choice of Obama as business as usual. Is there any truth in that?
Yeah, you know, I can definitely see where that comes from. I don't necessarily want to subscribe to those exact words, but you know, Larry Summers has been around for a while. He's been around the block. He's worked in past administrations. He's you know, well known to people in Washington, and that's a big reason why I think he's got appeal to the Obama administration, which in a lot of its cabinet positions has opted for people who are very close and very loyal to the administration and maybe aren't outsiders and newcomers to the political realm. And so I think that I see where that's coming from. Janet Yellen is much more of an outsider pick. She doesn't necessarily have as many ties to the Washington establishment. So the question is whether the Obama administration, again, and this is a question they faced in many cabinet appointments, whether they pick the person they're closest to or whether they pick the kind of aspirational pick that may be a little bit more outside the box.
And do we have a good sense, when we look at both of them, how they would deal with big banks in this country, what they've said about that, whether or not they would be tough on big banks, perhaps prosecute some of them?
You know, I feel like we've kind of gotten past the concept of prosecuting big banks. I think that if it was going to happen in an administration, it probably would have happened in the Obama administration. I think that we're much more just kind of talking about the future of the economic recovery and the jobs market and things like that. And as far as differences between the two of them, I'm not sure that we can say that there's a whole lot of really key differences at this point, because we don't know how that they lead once they got in that position, which is a very unique position that none of us can really prepare for necessarily in any real good way.
Let's move on to an issue we've been covering pretty frequently, and that's voter ID and what's happened as a result of the Supreme Court decision. You wrote a piece recently, Rand Paul, saying no objective evidence exists that African Americans are prevented from voting, and you looked at whether or not that was true. Is it?
You know, it's the point that Rand Paul made was basically that, you know, there are a certain amount of states and areas of the country that are governed by the Voting Rights Act, And before the Supreme Court's decision this summer, striking down the formula used to determine where these certain jurisdictions are and which areas of the country require the Justice Department to sign off on any changes like voter ID, Rand Paul basically made the point that African-American turnout and turnout overall in these jurisdictions is not lower than it is elsewhere in the country. So the implication is that there's no voter suppression necessarily happening in these areas because turnout is not being suppressed. You know, I think that the left would make the argument that the reason that there is no evidence of suppression is because the Voting Rights Act has been working for a number of decades. So really, it's a matter of interpretation. You know, I think that the political left is making a significant effort to argue that voter ID laws are a form of voter suppression, that they will reduce turnout among African Americans. And, you know, in future elections here, when there's not necessarily going to be an African American president on the top of the ballot, it may be a situation where we would see African American turnout decrease regardless of those efforts. So this debate is continuing. It's going to be a big debate. Democrats are going to press this really hard because they know that they need African Americans to continue to turn out if they want to win future elections, especially in the midterms. And it's just a very important and vital debate that's happening in a lot of states right now.
You contrast what Paul said with what Hillary Clinton said. Anybody who says that the racial discrimination is no longer a problem in American elections must not be paying attention.
Yeah, and that speaks to what I was talking about, which is that Democrats in future elections need to have African Americans turn out like they have been for President Obama in 2008 and 2012. There is a concern among Democratic strategists, Democratic leaders, and I'm sure people in Hillary Clinton's circles that if she is the Democratic Party nominee, African Americans don't maybe turn out the way they did in 2008 and 2012, which was actually in 2012 higher than white turnout, which had never happened before. So the concern is that once there's no longer an African American president on the ballot, that turnout drops off and it hurts Democrats in a significant way because obviously that's a very homogenous vote in favor of Democrats. So I think that's part of this effort too, but there's also just a general acknowledgement that a lot of these voter ID laws and voting rights laws that are passing in Republican state legislatures, you know, you can justify them in any way you want, but the practical effect of a lot of them, at least if you believe most analysts, is that they will help Republicans.
You cite a revealing poll as well. 63% of black voters seeing voter suppression as a major problem compared with just 34% of white voters.
It's a huge, huge divide.
It is.
And it kind of harkens back to the Zimmerman case. There was just such a different perception of what justice meant in the Zimmerman-Trayvon Martin situation. And it's kind of the same thing. You know, African Americans and Caucasian Americans just have very different views of the situation when it comes to voting rights. And that's why we, you know, that's why I think this debate is so important. If Democrats can convince African Americans that Republicans are trying to take away their voting rights, in essence, that's a very powerful motivating factor and could really, you know, continue to make African Americans turn out to vote and also may, you know, spur them, if they don't have some kind of voter ID, to go get it and make sure that they turn out to vote.
Before we go to phone calls, and we'll start taking them in just one moment, you probably saw Maureen Dowd's column yesterday, which is a pretty scathing column against the Clintons. I hate to do this on Bill Clinton's, 68th birthday, which is today. But it indicated that she made a couple points, one which I thought was important, that Harry Truman is probably the only president who really didn't take any financial advantage from being in office and was only getting this pension of like $112 a month until he wrote his memoirs. Contrast that with the Clintons. She would indicate in her column yesterday that there are some financial shenanigans that may be going on that may need to be investigated. Do you see trouble down the road for Hillary Clinton's presidential campaign? Should she start one with financial shenanigans?
Well, you know, it's it's certainly a question that she'd rather not have to deal with. You know, I don't know that there's any kind of smoking gun here that says that the Clintons did anything wrong necessarily. Politicians who serve in office almost without fail, like you said, once they leave office, they somehow become very in demand as speakers. They become valuable as members of boards of directors, and they often see their net worth skyrocket as a result of that. The question from there becomes whether there's something wrong with that and whether there's something that can be done about that. After all, these people are now out of office. There's no reason that Bill Clinton can't make money in any way he sees fit as long as it's legal. He's not going to be president again. But from a public policy perspective, I think some people would ask whether it's a healthy thing to have, you know, ex-presidents making this kind of money and basically, you know, cashing in on what they were able to accomplish, which was to become president. They can't take a lot of money for speeches while they're president, but once they're done, they can take exorbitant sums. And so, you know, I'm not sure how much this matters to your average voter in Iowa, for instance. Until there's really that smoking gun out there, I tend to think that these things are inside baseball and the kind of things that are discussed inside the Beltway. But we'll have to keep an eye on this because it certainly was a pretty extensive treatment from the New York Times that they gave this.
Aaron Blake, our guest for the first part of All Things Political. He is a political reporter for The Washington Post. We're welcoming phone calls for him, and here's how you reach us. 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. Email talk at WPR.org. Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show, and this is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Publications like Slate and Mother Jones now say they will no longer refer to Washington's football team as the Redskins. Veronica Rickard and Cynthia Schuster discuss Native American team names in today's culture on Central Time later today. We go to phone calls now for Aaron Blake. He is political reporter for The Washington Post, and we start our calls with Victor in Oconomowoc. Hello, Victor.
Hi, good afternoon. I understand you're doing a quick show on show tomorrow on Egypt. I have 3 points to make regarding Egypt real fast. We pay Egypt money in order, as a bribe, to prevent them from going to war with Israel. I'll let you consider that in tomorrow's show. Regarding the Tea Party and regarding Ms. Yellen, Tea Party's an astroturf organization. Koch money, Dick Armey money, Karl Rove money, helps stir the passions of, you know, basically older people to maintain the status quo with respect to their entitlements. As far as Ms. Yellen is concerned, she's my choice. Larry Summers is not qualified because he advocated for repeal of Glass-Steagall. He did not help the stimulus package be as large as it should be. And if Obama really wanted to shake up the situation, he'd appoint Paul Krugman. Thank you very much, and I'll take my response off.
That would certainly shake things up, but probably not very likely to happen. Aaron.
I don't know that I've heard the Paul Krugman for Fed Reserve Chairman from my sources in Washington, D.C., but, you know, I think that's a reflection of that. There's just a whole lot of uncertainty and kind of conflict as far as who this person should be. You know, I think that the caller speaks to the point of kind of turning the page and bringing in somebody new versus Larry Summers, who's kind of the comfortable choice for the administration.
Mm-hmm. How many calls are there for there to be a suspension of foreign aid to Egypt because of all that's going on there?
You know, it's increasing now because of the unrest over the last week. There was a vote in the Senate recently, which was sponsored by Rand Paul, which basically tried to cut off aid to Egypt. And this was a few weeks ago before what happened last week. And it got only 13 votes out of the 100 senators, so it didn't really go very far. However, over the weekend, there were more senators coming on board with this. John McCain, who generally is no friend of Rand Paul when it comes to foreign policy, basically said that he supports that idea of cutting off aid. And so I think that as this situation evolves, we may see more people jump on board with that. The question is whether it gets anywhere near the amount of support that it would need to pass in the Senate or to actually force the Obama administration's hand.
Thanks, Victor, for the call. Terry Lee in Milwaukee. Hello, Terry Lee.
Hi, I live in Mississippi, and I hope that the national press follows the laws that the Republican legislatures are proposing following the Supreme Court decision, because the efforts that they're going to suppress voters are just incredible, particularly when you look at rural, poor voters. IDs, they can't get them. They make sure that the only place you can get a state ID is 100 miles away. And they've got residency requirements now that if you move within 30 days, you have to immediately reapply for another voter certification. So the Republicans are just jumping on these ponies and riding it, and you bet they want to suppress the vote.
Aaron.
You know, there's a lot of talk about these issues right now has to do with voter ID. I would argue that in the case of what just happened in North Carolina, which is the big voter ID law that was just signed by the governor and in the Justice Department is threatening to fight against, the voter ID is obviously a very big portion of it, but there were also many other changes made. And these kinds of changes are happening in other states. We're talking about cutting back on early voting hours, for instance. Early voting is something that generally favors Democrats and has higher Democratic turnout than voting on Election Day. We're also seeing in North Carolina they got rid of same-day registration. They got rid of pre-registration for 16- and 17-year-olds who will be 18 on Election Day. Once again, these are things that evidence shows may hurt Democrats in these elections. Republicans argue that they're doing this to protect the integrity of elections, to save money. It's a debate that's going to be happening, but there's certainly a lot of things, as your caller said, going on in these Republican state legislatures, and this is an issue that we're going to see in the Supreme Court before too long.
So there were challenges, of course, to that as soon as the governor signed it into law. When do you anticipate we'll see the Supreme Court deal with these particular, with voter ID or with same-day registration or all of this? What form will it take in getting to the Supreme Court? And will it happen, do you think, relatively soon, Aaron?
You know, I think it's a matter of how the Justice Department plays its hand here. The Justice Department has said that after the Supreme Court struck down the Voting Rights Act or the portion of the Voting Rights Act, that it would continue to press the issue. It's not quite clear what their challenges, how their challenges will materialize and exactly what they will contest. But I think if you're looking for a case that's going to go to the Supreme Court, it's probably the Justice Department going up against this North Carolina voter ID law or going up against the Texas voter ID law, which is the other one that they've signaled they'd like to challenge. I think the fact that it would be the Justice Department being involved in this would make those laws much more the ones that would be decisive when it comes to the top court in the land.
Mm-hmm. Thanks, Terry Lee. Paul in Spooner, hi.
I'm wondering why we don't just have a setup that when a person gets their driver's license at 16 years old, when they turn 18, why don't they just become an automatic voter? Why do we make them go back and go through a second process to vote? They've already demonstrated, they've already provided their information, they already have their ID. It would be just natural that when you turn 18, you're automatically a registered voter. Why don't we do that?
You know, I think it has something to do with, the requirements for getting a driver's license and getting a and being able to vote aren't necessarily the same. You don't have to be necessarily a citizen to get a driver's license. There's also, the issue that we run into with government all the time, which is that different branches of government don't necessarily talk to each other. They don't necessarily interface with each other on a whole lot of things. So, you know, I think that's a practical solution to this issue. It's something that would involve implementation and costs and trying to get different agencies to work with one another. And, we'll see if that happens in the coming years here as we kind of reevaluate ourselves when it comes to voting rights and voter ID.
Thanks very much for the call. For those of you who are on hold for the NSA story, Spying on Americans, we're going to cover that the next half hour. Just one final thing from you, and that concerns Obamacare. And we were talking about conservative members of the House. I wanted to ask you, who's holding steadfast when it comes to a shutdown of the government unless Obama defunds Obamacare, which of course is not going to happen. So this really isn't going anywhere, even if it would pass the Senate, which it won't. He would veto this. So why is this being used? Is it just a good way, good thing to use for election purposes or what?
You know, I do think that there is a certain element of that. Republicans think that the implementation of Obamacare is going to go so poorly that it makes that, you know, it helps them in the 2014 election. I do think also, though, that, you know, this is a situation where they truly believe that they need to do whatever they can to get rid of Obamacare. And even the people who don't necessarily agree with this tactic will say that. But I don't think it's going to work. There are Republican senators who have already expressed their opposition to the strategy. You know, there may be a situation where it could potentially pass in the House, but even there I see it is kind of a symbolic thing that House would eventually pass a different budget that included funding for Obamacare because they don't want a government shutdown. Republicans recognize that a shutdown would reflect poorly on them, and I think ultimately that's why this will go by the wayside.
And yet the Obama administration has its own set of problems in rolling this out. I don't know if you saw this story today, but this is being unveiled today. The Department of Health and Human Services is debuting a video contest complete with cash prizes designed to persuade younger consumers to get insurance. You get prizes. Oh, my gosh.
Maybe that was the solution all along. We just need to offer some people some prizes for getting insurance.
I think that's the answer to everything, isn't it?
There you go. Yep.
That and free food.
Yeah.
Thanks so much, Aaron, for being with us.
Okay, thank you.
Thanks. Aaron Burke is political reporter for The Washington Post. You are listening to All Things Political here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Kathleen Dunn. We continue All Things Political. We're just changing guests. Philip Bump is joining us now. He is a staff writer for The Atlantic Wire, and our phone number is remaining the same, 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655, email talk at WPR.org. Facebook page is the Kathleen Dunn Show. Philip, hello. Thank you so much for being with us.
Hello, my pleasure.
Well, let's start with NSA privacy violations. You wrote a piece on this on Friday of this week. A couple questions right off the bat. What are all these thousands of privacy violations? This is a large number of violations. Sure. And the second thing is we're hearing concern from lawmakers. I have yet to sense a lot of outrage, which I think is hard to understand from the American public on this issue. But what were all these things we learned about violations?
It sort of depends on who you ask. So the Washington Post, working off of a document that had been leaked to them by Edward Snowden, revealed it was one document that was a report from the NSA that came out last March that detailed over 2,500 violations that had occurred between the second quarter of 2011 and the first quarter of 2012, and they ran the gamut. Many of the violations were what the NSA considered sort of mechanical violations. Someone entered a typo in a document, for example, and that was something that came up as a privacy violation. But the categories into which the NSA places those mistakes are fairly vague, and so the NSA assured the Washington Post and assures the American people that these were not intentional, that they were not trying to invade people's privacy. But there is one example in 2008 that the Post reported, which was that the government was looking for phone calls from Egypt that began with the country code 20 and ended up scooping up a bunch of 202 or Washington, D.C. area code phone numbers. So, you know, that is a simple mistake, and it is one that could, you know, be considered operator error, but it's significant, and it means that a lot of Americans had their information collected when that wasn't supposed to happen.
Mm-hmm. There are all these organizations, and I wonder how effective they are. You've obviously investigated these. What you call depleted intelligence advisory panel for the president, also the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Court, which is a secret body. How many different organizations are looking into this spying? Are there a sufficient number, and what are they doing?
there are a number of organizations that are meant to be protecting Americans' privacy. And I think one of the things that we learned, particularly in the aftermath of the Washington Post report, is that that oversight isn't happening as robustly as the NSA has claimed or as many Americans would like. There is the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Court, which you referred to, which is the court that actually authorizes the NSA to conduct its surveillance. But in a corollary story to the Post's report, the head of that court said, we don't get the information that we would need in order to be able to actually conduct this oversight effectively. There's a presidential body that is meant to do similar sort of oversight and review of privacy measures. It has only four members when it was supposed to have over a dozen. There is another recently impaneled or advisory board, which was one of the recommendations after the 9/11 commission did its report. It only recently came into action. It's got five people on it. They've had their first couple of meetings, primarily because of the Snowden leaks. And then, of course, there's congressional oversight. And one of the things that the Washington Post revealed was that there are all these violations that had happened, but Senator Dianne Feinstein indicated that she hadn't seen the report prior. We spoke with Mike Rogers, Representative Mike Rogers, who's the chairman of the House Intelligence Committee. He said he had seen the report, and yet he told media outlets that he hadn't seen violations prior to the Post report. So it is not clear if the oversight that the NSA is, you know, held up as we are doing what we've been tasked to do and people are watching us do it, if that actually exists.
Why is it, maybe I don't have the right perception here, but why is it, it would appear to me that the American public are not very upset about this? Or maybe they are.
Well,
are they?
Sure. Well, I think that attitudes are evolving. Part of the problem is that, you know, only a very small group of people in the United States truly understands the scope of what's happening. And one of the rationales that Snowden used when he was, releasing these documents was that he thought that more information should be out there. And regardless of what you think of Snowden and his motivations, that has absolutely happened, that now we have a much better sense for what exactly is happening with the NSA surveillance. And even members of Congress have expressed in the aftermath of these leaks that they didn't know and that they were underinformed about the things that they were deciding on. So I think that's one key thing, is that you know, even members of Congress are still getting up to speed, and so Americans who pay less attention to this sort of thing are as well. But over the course of time, since beginning of June when the leaks first came out, polling has started to trend towards people feeling as though this is an unacceptable intrusion on their privacy.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that, you know, certain polls have shown that more than half of Americans now feel that way.
Well, you still don't know, because it is so massive and there is so much money being spent on all of this. You don't really know whether any worthwhile information, a lot of worthwhile information, a couple important pieces of information has come as a result of this massive effort.
That's right. Yeah, I mean, the information about what terrorist actions have been broken up is primarily classified as well. And so the NSA hails this number 54, which is the number of interruptions of terrorist activity, not necessarily an interrupted plot, but, you know, just any way in which this information has helped them step in front of a terrorist or someone who's trying to help the terrorist. But they've only released details of, I think, four at this point, such incidences. And one of the only public one that relates to the phone metadata, which is the collection of all of the information about, you know, who, what phone number you're calling, what phone number is being called from, and the length of the phone call. There's only been one public, one declassified action that has interrupted that the NSA talks about, and that was that the NSA was able to keep someone who was raising money for a terrorist organization in Somalia from doing that any longer.
Hmm.
So much of this is, we can't know what we don't know because of how the NSA's classification
right.
system works, which totally makes sense, and they need to have that classification, but it's very hard for us to evaluate and, you know, how effective these tools are.
Let's take a couple phone calls on this issue. Philip Bump is our guest, staff writer for the Atlantic Wire, All Things Political and the Ideas Network. 800-486-8655 is our number. Rick in Milwaukee, thanks for waiting. Hi.
Hi. My concern is that these small reviews by Congressman Rogers, Senator Feinstein, and so much are just that. They're just little pokes, little dribs and drabs at taking on an enormous issue. We're talking about an intelligence agency, supposedly for our benefit, that's spending $30 to $40 billion a year scooping up our privacy. And it's going to take something much more exhaustive, something more comprehensive by the government to ever get my belief in this system back intact. Something like the Church Committee hearings from the 70s that looked into the abuses of the U.S. intelligence agencies, which were extensive then. They were horrible then. We had people being killed by United States intelligence agents illegally, all kinds of assassination projects. So I think that what's happening with the NSA now is much bigger than what's been disclosed by Edward Snowden or others. And it's going to take that kind of large investigation to get a grasp on this thing. And I'm wondering if you're hearing that something like the Church Committee is going to be set up by the Senate or both branches of Congress to take on this issue.
So it's a very good question, and the Church Commission has come up a number of times in the aftermath of the Snowden leaks. I haven't heard anyone who is calling for a similar sort of commission at this point. I would say, though, that your examples of Senator Dianne Feinstein and Representative Rogers are two of the most staunch advocates for these programs as the chairs of the Senate and House Intelligence Committees. They have universally defended the NSA's actions here. But there are a number of elected officials who have been far more critical. There's Ron Wyden of Oregon, Senator Ron Wyden. There is Representative Justin Amash from Michigan. There are a number of people who are trying to figure out if there are ways in which to reform the system, particularly to roll back some of the phone metadata collection under the Patriot Act, without going through a full reassessment of the NSA surveillance. Now, one of the things that the president announced during his press conference 2 weeks ago was an independent commission that could look at, overall, is this an effective balance of Americans' privacy and our need to halt terrorist action? So that will be coming down the pike. I think by December is when they're expected to unveil their findings.
Thanks, Rick, very much for your call. We'll take more in a moment. All Things Political is what you're listening to. Philip Bump is our guest this half hour, staff writer for the Atlantic Wire. 800-486-8655 is the number, and we have a few lines open if you'd like to join us. You can also leave a message at talk@WPR.org. Facebook page is the Kathleen Dunn Show. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up next hour, economist and writer Allison Schrager about what Detroit's pension woes could signal for the rest of the country. Let's go back to phone calls. Ronaldo in Milwaukee. Hello, Ronaldo.
Hello. I get a kick out of your comment earlier was you don't think people are upset. The reason why you're not seeing it is because the media is not covering it. What I gather in the media is they resort to the Patriot Act under Bush, What this president here is doing is nothing compared to the Patriot Act. This is a search warrant to investigate and to pry into people's business of over a population of 350 million people. And if the media would cover that, there would be outrage. There are plenty of people I hear that are outraged. Their voice is not being heard.
Philip.
So, you know, obviously, as someone who's a member of the media, I would take some issue with that. But,
I know you have covered it.
right. Well, you know, but I get the concern, which is that there is a complicated issue at stake. You know, there are two different laws, both of which have been amended multiple times. The Patriot Act of 2001, which was amended to allow for this phone metadata collection with the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Court authorizing it, as well as the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act. Which was amended several times, and that is what authorizes things like this PRISM system, which collects information from people overseas. They are very complex issues, and they are things that require a lot of explication when you're reporting about them. Could we be reporting on it more? Certainly, you can always be reporting on it more, but I think that at the end of the day, that this is something which hasn't yet reached a point of saturation, that you know, these leaks began at the beginning of June. The Guardian started reporting on these at that point in time, and it's only been a couple of months. And if you look at some of the other things, like the Church Commission that we talked about earlier, I mean, that took years following some of the revelations of what the CIA had been doing. So this is still very early in the process, and as I said, we are already seeing some change in terms of public attitude.
Thanks, Rinaldo. Mary in Eau Claire, hi.
Hi. I wanted to tell this story. I've contributed to the Democratic Party in the past, and about a week ago, I got a telephone call from a Democratic Party person asking for money from the National Committee. And I said, no, I'm not giving you any money as long as you support this PRISM program. And she said, not even $10. And I said, no, I want you to tell them that PRISM program is going to hurt them. And then she hung up on me.
I'm amused that $10 was the value that she assumed was still acceptable. but, you know, I mean, the Democratic Party needs to raise a lot of money for 2014. It's got a number of big races coming up, and, you know, it is not as though you were getting a call probably from someone at Democratic National Headquarters in Washington. It's a paid person probably to do so,
right,
whose job is to try and raise this money. But, you know, this is a problem that is pointed out here, which is that Democrats are actually I forget what the most recent poll is, but they are, in most polls that I've seen, more accepting of the surveillance systems than are Republicans, which is a reversal from when it was polls were conducted under Bush.
Right.
Yes, I mean, but not by much. It's generally fairly even now. But under the Bush administration, that was reversed. The Republicans were far more likely to support the surveillance. So there is some, you know, I think that the Democratic Party can still count on a decent base of people who are going to still support their candidates and still contribute. And that phone call was them, you know, testing the waters. So,
wouldn't it be a really good idea if when those people are making the calls, they would have said to Mary, well, Mary, we don't have a lot of time, but we have a minute or so here. Please tell me what your concerns are so that people in the party can hear Mary's concerns and all the other people they call for solicitation.
Sure. No, agreed. And, you know, probably not to hang up on them either would also be smart.
You're absolutely right about that. Thanks very much, Mary, for the call. I want to talk a little bit about this recess period that's going on. It's an indication that August does tend to be a little bit slow. But I'm wondering, as you look at what members of Congress are doing when they go back to their home districts during this particular month, do you think that they are in for any surprises? Have you heard of town hall meetings taking place where they're being confronted with votes on certain kinds of issues, or if there's something that's under the radar that Washington just hasn't been keyed into?
The town halls are interesting, in part because not every member of Congress is assiduous about holding them as, you know, his peers. There have been a number that have included some contentious moments. I've seen a few clips. Yeah, I mean, one of the great things about the town halls these days is that everyone there has a phone and can record video snippets, and it is, I think, a great tool for holding members of Congress accountable. So I've seen several of these snippets. There have been a number of times in which people have been frustrated about these exact NSA surveillance issues. Also, immigration has come up a number of times. The House Republicans are getting a lot of pressure from their constituents about, and I shouldn't say a lot, you know, this is anecdotal based on the things that exist on YouTube, basically. I mean, not everyone can go to every single town hall, but they're definitely getting some pushback on a pathway to citizenship and supporting the Senate bill on immigration. And then, of course, the other big issue that I heard you speaking a little bit about before was the Affordable Care Act or Obamacare,
right,
and whether or not that gets implemented.
Right. Well, haven't we already had that conversation? Isn't that conversation, obviously implementation has its own set of perhaps large problems, but didn't we struggle with that whole issue when we passed Obamacare and most of it is legal, and isn't that usually an indication that that's it?
Usually. You know, I mean, the big town hall debates of 2009 were predicated on the Affordable Care Act, on Obamacare. You know, that was the first round, really, when the Tea Party was ascendant, and Congress members were hearing, we don't want to have this, you know, government-run healthcare system. And now it is interesting to see that it is resurgent, and that is in part because when Congress passed the bill, they pushed it out into the future, both so that they could make sure that implementation went as smoothly as possible and also to get it past the 2012 election to some extent. Yes, it is. There is it's a sort of deja vu when it comes to the politics of these town halls. But I think that you're right that the October 1st deadline is key, and it happens to coincide with this debt ceiling fight and with trying to fund the government, and that is making things uncomfortable for the president.
Right. Let's go to Diane in Milwaukee. Hi, Diane.
Good morning. Good afternoon. When you consider not supporting the Democratic Party by not voting or not supporting them with money, consider what you get with the alternative.
Yeah, that is part of the point I was trying to make about the polling is that, you know, these are all systems that began in the Bush administration, that this was not the Obama administration saying, hey, we've got this idea for how we can survey Americans and take a look at what they're doing. This has been in the works for an extended period of time, for over a decade, some of these programs, not all of them, and that, you know, this is a government agency which has tools at its disposal, which it is using based on the interpretation of the law from this secret court. This is, if all of a sudden there were a new president in 2016, if none of this stuff had come to light, it's a fair bet that the policies would have continued as is.
Mm-hmm. Well, it seems to me as though the policies on counterterrorism have been pretty similar, be you a Democrat or be you a Republican, that nobody wants to see a repeat of September 11. So you're seeing some policies, drone strikes, et cetera, that some members of the Democratic Party are very, very upset about. But there seems to be quite a hardline policy here.
Yeah. One of the problems of being an elected official, if you will, is that you are part of a political party and you are expected to toe the political party's line, which is not what constituents like to hear, but it is one of the ways that things get done in Washington, that parties come together and agree how they're going to vote on a particular piece of policy, and then that piece of policy has a better chance of passing or not. One of the big challenges that Speaker Boehner has had is that he has a group of legislators who are more willing than the norm to buck his leadership. Yes, it is the case that that these sorts of things will exist, you know, independent of who is actually leading them.
Mm-hmm. So give me an indication, Philip, as we approach midterm time and as we look at, alas, a presidential election, which is probably we're already talking about it and speculating about it. I'm still trying to understand what the issues are among members of the Tea Party or Tea Party groups in this country. It was Obamacare. It was government spending, et cetera, bailouts of companies. What is it now? And can you give me an assessment of the political clout this organization has?
One of the things that made the Tea Party successful is that it was never a centralized organization. It was more of a mantra. It was groups of people that were coming together to advocate for smaller government, to advocate for less regulation, to advocate for conservative political priorities. And that was both a strength and a drawback. It was a strength in that it allowed them to spread rapidly and grow quickly. It was a drawback because it made it harder to centralize their political power. So now I think that there is a broad range of people who identify as members of the Tea Party who hold fairly divergent value sets. That does not mean, though, that in particular areas where there are going to be races next year in 2014 or even in 2016, that they are not going to have political power. They tend to be regionally focused. And as we saw even just last year with some of the Senate races, they were still able to win primary elections and advance more conservative candidates. And I think that will be the norm for at least the short term.
What do you mean by short term?
Well, I mean, I think it certainly is the case that in 2014 there will be conservative groups who call themselves Tea Party organizations who are able to affect primary elections. I'm not sure if that continues into 2016. I think it depends in part upon national politics and who ends up being the likely nominee from the Republican Party.
Well, they'll be very interesting midterms, won't they?
Oh, yes. I mean, they always are, right?
Right.
I mean, you know, if you're a political junkie...
Well, they are to us,
like
of course.
Yeah, exactly. Right. And hopefully anyone listening. For,
right.
But, you know, they are... yeah, because you really get some of the minutiae and some of the local issues that can be interesting.
Right. Philip, thank you ever so much for being with us. I enjoyed your presence. Thanks.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Philip Bump, staff writer for the Atlantic Wire, our guest for this half hour of All Things Political, preceded by Aaron Blake, political reporter for The Washington Post. You hear All Things Political every Monday at 1 o'clock here on the Ideas Network. Thanks to KP Whaley and Rhonda Fanning for producing the program. Thanks for your phone calls. And just a reminder that we have news coming up from National Public Radio, and we have another hour. People have wondered about the financial healthiness of pension systems as a result of what happened in Detroit. So please stay with us. We'll talk all about that in just a few moments.